Welcome to Dangerous Wisdom, a journey into mystery and a gateway to the mind of nature and the nature of mind. This is Dr. Nikos, your friendly neighborhood soul doctor, happy to be here with you so that together we can create a culture of wisdom, love, and beauty. Auspicious interbeing to you and yours, my friends, Koinos Hermes, a deep bow to Sophia, Gaia Sophia, and Cosmic Sophia. We're recording live as usual. Live in front of a celestial audience here at the Dangerous Wisdom Studios in the Maxa Regia, the Santa Cruz Mountains. And we have a delightful guest today, my friends, a novelist, and we're talking novels. So Manda Scott is with us. She is an award-winning novelist and host of the acclaimed Accidental Gods podcast. Best known for the Boudicca Dreaming series. Her previous novels have been shortlisted for the Orange Prize, the Edgar Wilbur Smith, and Saltire Awards, and won the McIlvany Prize. Her latest novel, Any Human Power, is a mytho-political thriller which lays out a Thrutopian roadmap to a flourishing future. We'd be proud to leave to the generations that come after us. With degrees in veterinary medicine and a master's in regenerative economics, Manda's life is oriented towards creating radical new narratives that will pave the way to the total systemic change our culture and our world needs. We'll have links for her book and podcasts and other things. Welcome to Dangerous Wisdom, Wisdom Sister. How are you?
Thank you. It's an honor to be here and a delight. Ooh. That was a grand introduction. I'm very impressed. So thank you. Yeah.
Oh, yes, the delight is ours. Wisdom is delight. It's the path of joy and wonder. Yeah. And your book is an entrance into wonder. I detect, I was pleased to see some shamanic and wisdom tradition elements, including the presence of horse. I don't want to give anything away, but horse makes an appearance, which is, of course, precious to me. And I suspect there are some hoof prints in this somewhere in the background. Did the spirit of horse do more than just appear in the book?
Oh, yes. Yes. I used to be a veterinary surgeon, which on your side of the Atlantic would be a veterinarian. And I worked in Newmarket, which is kind of like the English version of Kentucky. It's the home of racing. We had an American student at one point who reckoned that she did some arithmetic, reckoned there were 6,000 people and 16,000 horses within the town limits of Newmarket. So I spent most of my professional career looking after, I specialized in intensive care of neonatal foals, which is quite niche in the veterinary field.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, if you're in Newmarket and someone's just paid in those days, £250,000, which in those days was probably billions now, for the stud fee to get a foal, they would pay anything at all to keep it alive once it was born. So it was one of the best funded areas of veterinary medicine in terms of if you wanted the machines that go ping, that's a Monty Python reference for those of you who get it, then you just ordered it. And later on I went to work. So Cambridge, Newmarket, practices and then I think a place called the Animal Health Trust, which was a research unit. I kind of oscillated between those three. So I went from the practice back to the vet school at Cambridge and discovered that, you know, I want a machine. And they go, no, sorry, you're in a queue behind radiology, cardiology, ophthalmology and the surgeons, and you're never going to see your machine, which was quite a shock. But anyway, yes. And so I worked, specialized working with horses. And then when I gave up being a vet and became a novelist, I wrote the Boudicca series, and the Ikeni, who were the primary tribe that around which the Boudiccan revolt revolved, were horse breeders. That's one of the things that Caesar said of them. So they bred horses in 2,000 years ago in ancient Britain. And then I came to Shropshire, and I live on the side of a hill, and I live in a small holding, and down in the yard are three ponies, including a foal that I bred myself. I promised myself when I was working in Newmarket with everybody else's foals that one day I would breed my own. So she's got quite a lot of projection landed on her little shoulders, but she's doing okay. She's going off to be backed this year.
Mm. And then was there some more horse presence in the generation of this
novel? Oh, I see. That was a whole bunch of stuff you didn't really want. Yeah. Okay. So if we center a little bit, I have practiced contemporary shamanic spirituality is my path, and I've been teaching it now for 25 years. And yes, in the circle that I work with are many horses. And they offer a lot of wisdom. So yes, the core bottom line answer is yes.
That. Yeah, yeah. So this book is, we've seen dystopian stories and we've seen utopian stories. And this is a thrutopian story. How do we get through? The way out is through. The way out is through, yes. Yeah. Yeah. And so that's what this novel is about. How do we imagine ourselves out of a mess that seems overwhelming to contemplate?
Yeah, because if we don't, we can build all the utopian ideas that we like, but if we can't see how to get there, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
And we have all the answers. It's not that we lack the answers, we just lack the political will. And I think we lack the political will because we don't have the stories that lead us there. Our stories are all of scarcity, separation, and powerlessness instead of connection, sufficiency, and agency. Mm-hmm. So we need the stories.
I mean, these are part of the function of the mythopoetic story. And and here Plato comes to mind because he understood how powerful the arts can be. And then he said, well, you've got to be careful who you've got making arts because of how powerful. But we have the mistaken notion, as I often try to correct. Some of you have heard this a million times, but we need to hear. He didn't say he didn't want poets and artists. He said he didn't want ignorant poets. And so you have done what I think more and more people are doing in the arts, which is root the creative process in a spiritual life, that if it's rooted in a spiritual life. And so your practice has been shamanic. Can you talk about that? Because that's a little, there's a way in which that sounds very, like it feels as if we need that sort of nutriment, and at the same time, it feels almost divorced from us, and almost one might think, well, shamanic has to go with indigenous, and so where would we get these? Where would we get these practices? How would we engage in the shamanic now in this context? What drew you to it? How did you get to it, and what does it mean to you?
Those are big questions. I will try and keep this brief, but I would say before we even get there, I frame the world these days through the lenses of initiation culture and trauma culture.
Okay.
And I think our job, our generation, anyone alive on the earth now, is to shift from trauma culture, which is the hegemonic culture, into an initiation culture. If we cannot do that, I don't think we're going to make it through.
Okay, so that's a big, that's a big point to digest. Okay, so and there are lots of ways to maybe characterize our culture. It's interesting because there was a dialogue last year
about trauma
and about how it seems to be a dominant culture concept, and that the culture seems to be good at producing it. So it's a very it's not like Dangerous Wisdom has never considered this notion. I like So it seems like our culture is really good at producing and traumatizing its own citizens and other beings, whether they're human or not, whether they're within the borders or not. And then there's this other idea, initiation culture. Okay. Maybe you say a little bit about that before we talk about the...
Yes. So the first thing to say is this comes directly from Francis Weller. And I'm not altogether comfortable with the nomenclature. But Francis Weller is a trauma therapist, and he learned from Maladoma Somme. So he gets to call it what he wants to call it. So in his framing, and I will tell you when I shift away from that, initiation cultures are all of human evolution, 300,000 years, or if you want to go back 64 million years to the last mass extinction, however long you want to frame it, or a billion years since we were hydrogen boiling in the sun, billions of years. And all of the indigenous, whole untraumatized indigenous cultures on the world today. And that's separate from our culture, which is a trauma culture and has been so for probably 12,000 years. We can look at that. So in initiation cultures are the hallmark of an initiation culture is that individuals within it undergo intermittent, episodic, contained encounters with death. And the containment is held by the elders, by the shamans, by the whole of the serotonin mesh of tribal culture, and explicitly by the more than human world, the web of life. And we tend to fixate on the adolescent rites of passage, but actually birth is one of these, both for the infant and the mother. Death is one of these, and you move with grace into the next space. It's a rite of passage as much as anything else, and you meet it with the same courage you'd meet any other rite of passage. And rites of passage happen all the time. But if we look at them explicitly, what happens is the individual gets to the edges of themselves where death is a probability. And because of the way they are raised, knowing themselves to be an integral part of the web of life, they ask for help of the web. And provided they can receive and act on that help, they survive. And then they come back to the people in whatever way back is, because illness is often one of these. It's not just I just go out into the wilderness and sit in a rock for 6 days. Whatever it is, you return and you know more of your integral nature within the web of life. You know how to ask for help. You know that help will be given. And you know more of who you are. I know what's mine to do. I know what only I can do and what I can do best. And I can take tremendous pride in that in a way that's a serotonin pride, not a hubris, dopaminergic pride. And I am surrounded by people that I respect, for whom I have absolute respect because they are doing what's theirs to do and what only they can do best. Mm-hmm. And I trust, I absolutely have that core trust in the web of human and more than human connections. And that is an initiation culture. Nothing truly bad can ever happen because the web of life and the web of the people are so integral that they cannot be broken. On the flip side of that, we have the trauma culture, where somewhere along the line, a long, long, many, many, many generations ago, before we started our westernized form of agriculture, which basically enslaves parts of the web of life, encloses them, enslaves them, and orders them and controls them, we lost the knowing of that. Or it was severed somehow. Either we severed it by choice or it was severed. We're never going to know, and there's not a great deal of point in losing bandwidth trying to decide that something happened, and we don't grow knowing that we are an integral part of the web of life. Mm-hmm. We grow thinking that we are isolated individuals in a world where the basic rule is whoever dies with the most toys wins. Or as Mickey Kashtan says, the rules are scarcity, separation, and powerlessness. And all that matters is getting to the top of a very steep-sided pyramid that, by its nature, gives power to the dark triad. Mm. Whereas in initiation cultures, anybody evincing the dark triad is helped to not do that very fast, or everybody just walks away.
Then people might not know
the dark triad does not.
Yeah, what that
okay. Dark
is.
Triad is yeah. is psychopathy, narcissism, and sadism.
Yeah.
Some people say raw cunning also, but I think raw cunning comes into the psychopathy. So psychopathy, narcissism, sadism.
Yeah.
And our culture is expressly designed to give those power over everybody else.
Yeah.
And this is not a clever thing to have done. So for me, you asked about indigenous cultures. I live on the islands of Britain. The Romans imported the trauma culture to the islands of Britain. And that it's not that they invented it. I'm not suggesting that they did. I think it was existing a long, long time before the Romans turned up in, first of all, Caesar in 43 BC and then Claudius in 43 AD. But they were very, very good at exporting it, what was then the known world. So India to the east, up to Hadrian's Wall in Britain, down into Africa, and to the limits of Britain, of Europe to the west. They didn't go. They didn't really go to Ireland. That was the western limit. So we had that imposed upon us. But the old gods of the land are still here. I think that's the thing that is really clear once you start to work with them. And so you asked where it came from. When I was very single figures young, I had a number of experiences. I don't know, it could take time. I I read a number of books. I went to a particular place in Scotland. I'll tell you this bit. So it's the it's monuments called brochs, which exist all over Scotland. But my father took us, me and my brother, to one at Glenelg, which is on the mainland opposite Skye. And it's about, I think it's 80 feet in diameter. And it's a stone. It originally was a beehive shape, very tall, very big. And the walls are about, I think, 8 feet apart at the base. And they curve up. And there's seven stories. And in the winter, the cattle were in between the walls at the bottom. And then there would be hay, and then there was corn, and then there's other things. And the people were in the center surrounded by the cattle and they ate the corn. And there's sufficient uniformity in these that somebody or a group of people who knew how to build them was obviously traveling around building them. And they're Paleolithic, basically. And I had just read a number of things, mostly a book called The Eagle of the Ninth, which you will never have heard of, but when I talk about it in British podcasts and people of a certain age, I'll go, oh, yes. Because this was Rosemary Sutcliffe brought it, I think, in the 60s. And it was one of the very, very early sword and sandals books. So this is Romans in Britain. It didn't exist until then, those kinds of books. And the story is of Marcus, whose father was the legate of the 9th Legion, and it had lost its eagle, and that's the absolute disaster. And if you could have 4,999 people left in a legion, but they lost the eagle, the legion was disbanded. This is fact. If there was one person left and they had the eagle, the legion would be reformed. So losing your eagle was a big disaster. And actually, it turns out the 9th didn't actually lose their eagle, but that's a separate thing. So in the fiction, eagle lost, bad thing. Marcus joins up with Eska, who is his slave, who is one of the indigenous peoples. It's so colonial and so misogynist when I read it again as an adult. But as a 9-year-old, I didn't notice that. I was just, these people existed. And they go north of the wall, which was into, I was born and brought up in Scotland. So they arrive in Scotland and they arrive with the people of the Horned Moon God. No, the Seal people. And the priests of the Horned Moon God, who are the shamans of that time, have definitely got the eagle. And they've got it in what's effectively a long barrow, and there's a goatskin curtain. And they go in to do their rites, and we never see behind the goatskin curtain. And I read that book, and it became my life's mission at that point to know what happened behind the goatskin curtain.
Whoa. It's like a weird Wizard of Oz turn around. I want to see possibly what's behind the curtain.
I don't just want to see it. I want to know it and I want to do it, because they were connecting to the gods of this land. And that was my discovery growing up in a little Presbyterian village, that the land had gods that were much, much older than the psychopath I was being fed at home and at school.
Yeah. You know, that's bringing to mind an episode we did on Bateson and the ecology of mind, because right, he talks about the god that will not be mocked. And he talks about these large, if you like, I will briefly share with you a passage, and because I think you would appreciate it. But one of the things that I'm intrigued about is speaking of Bateson, is the issue that you raised about do I want to ask about this now? Okay, so well, let's just say you took up this path. Let's finish the thread of the story before I go someplace else with it. So you decided that this is what you wanted to do. But how does one begin to practice shamanism within the confines of the dominant culture? So those things are there, and
yes,
it's so important for all of us to remember that our ancestors were indigenous. We've all got some history. Not only that, but I always like to emphasize, we have traditions of wisdom, love, and beauty that have recorded teachings and even in some cases living teachings and teachers.
Yeah,
so exactly. We don't have to turn to something that might seem like maybe not everybody is drawn to shamanism. But how do you, for that particular vein of spiritual teachings, how did you enter it?
Good question. And I think I need to make a distinction between Druidry and shamanic practice, which is probably, I think, in generations down the line, if there ever are any, people will wonder why we bother making that distinction. And it's largely semantic and political, I think, probably. So I started off exploring Druidry, and this was back in the early 80s. And it was not connecting me to the gods of the land. We could go into what it was doing, but it just wasn't. And then I qualified as a vet in 84, and then I was incredibly lucky. By the usual flow of serendipity that makes these things happen, I became aware of the fact that from 85 onwards, I discovered in 85, there were Native American teachers whose spirits and guides had told them that they needed to start teaching white people or else we would destroy the earth. And it was very controversial. There were those who were wanting to teach us, and there were those who said, you absolutely can't, they are not adult enough, you can't do this. But for a while, there was a short window where they were very free with their teaching, and they were teaching us to connect with the gods of the land here. They were not teaching us to be pseudo-North Americans or Sami or Australians or Africans. They were teaching us, the gods are here. You just need to learn the tools of practice to know how to talk to them. And then late 80s, early 90s, the death cult of predatory capitalism being what it is, a bunch of disparate individuals decided that it was entertaining, useful and fun to start offering workshops where basically pay me $1,000 and I will teach you to be a shaman in a weekend, which is not a thing. And you know this and I know this. This is the oldest and most powerful spiritual practice on the planet. And it's also extremely dangerous if you mess about with it. And it's either that or you can learn it in a weekend, and it cannot be both. And yet these people were basically scamming money off people, and the doors, they didn't close completely, but all the people who'd been saying you can't teach these people because they are not adult enough were proved right. So I was incredibly fortunate to have been around and active and frankly to have had some free time. Later in my professional career, I just wouldn't have had the time. I had weekends where I could go away to go and learn from this really free giving of, here are the tools, use them here and now. And now I think contemporary Druidry as it is in 2025, to an extent, there are people probably doing that. And there is no doubt that Druidry was the shamanic practice of the islands of Britain. When I wrote the Boudicca books, I called it dreaming, because even then, when I was writing them at the turn of the millennium, the narrative in the general public of Druids was people wearing bedsheets at Stonehenge. It just wasn't a useful, or Asterix and Obelix and Getafix. That's a cartoon set you either know or don't. It wasn't a word that I wanted to work with. And also I teach what we call dreaming awake. So there are different ways that we can move from this reality into the other realities, and sleep dreams and waking dreams are one of them. And I don't use entheogens, so dreaming is the primary tool that I would use. So for all those reasons, the Boudicca books were called Dreaming the Eagle, Dreaming the Bull, Dreaming the rest of it. And dreaming was the word that I used rather than Druidry. But I could have used Druidry. And under other political circumstances, I might have done. Does that answer the question that you asked?
No, I mean, this is very rich because, I mean, the reason for those listening, this is a mytho-political thriller, and I don't want to give away too many plot points. I think it's very important. I mean, I want to ask Amanda later to read a little bit from it, but I wanted to emphasize and highlight process here, because I think that there is a radically different way of making art. Just as we have to learn to live in general differently, I think that the saying is that the artist visits the place where the mystic dwells. But if the artist can learn to live there, can learn to abide there, it changes the whole nature of the art. It changes what comes out, right? And so knowing that a work of art has been produced through this kind of like deeper process, we could say more holistic, moving from and toward wholeness rather than the kind of fragmentation that the culture just... downloads into everybody, if we can use a mechanistic metaphor. I mean, we're all seduced into this culture in order to grow up in it and talk the language and pay our bills. So there's a deep thing. And one of the things I wanted to share with you that's very relevant here, and I have shared this one before, but I thought it might be nice. Did you ever come across this passage from Jung where he went, when he was talking about his visit to East Africa? I don't know if you, we'll see. Some listeners will have heard this before, but there's a place, a philosopher, a professional sort of non-university professor, but a philosopher in the more proper sense. We all have a medicine bag, and sometimes the little thing that you're taking out, it might be a poem, or maybe you have to sing a song, which nobody wants me to do. But sometimes it's a little bit of text or a story or an image. So this is just one of those stones in my medicine bag that I think is important for right now. And here's what Jung says. When I went to East Africa, I went to a small tribe in Mount Elgon, and I asked the medicine man about dreams. He said, "I know what you mean. My father still had dreams." I said, "You have no dreams?" And then he wept and answered, "No, I have no dreams anymore." I asked, "Why?" He answered, "Since the British came into the country." "Now, how is that?" He said, "The district commissioner knows when there shall be war. He knows when there are diseases. He knows where we must live. He does not allow us to move. The political guidance is now represented by the DC, by the superior intelligence of the white man. Therefore, why should they need dreams? Dreams were the original guidance of human beings in the great darkness. Read that book of Rasmussen's about the polar Eskimos. There he describes how a medicine man became the leader of his tribe on account of a vision. When a human is in the wilderness, the darkness brings the dreams, somnia edeo misa, that guide them. It has always been so." I think it kind of speaks to what you were getting at.
Yeah.
Thank you. It's there. And this also shows the destabilizing effect of what I refer to as conquest consciousness rather than, I appreciate trauma culture is a good way to characterize it, but I usually call it conquest consciousness. And it's destabilizing. You can see two people who might otherwise be, I mean, this is the problem. It's sort of viral. And even indigenous people who, ancestors, descendants who had indigenous ancestors sometimes feel that they have to re-indigenize too because of this destabilizing force. So we're all kind of in it together. The notion
are you familiar with the Wetiko, the Wendigo concept?
Yeah, right.
Because it is, and I think that's one of the hallmarks of that is that it's contagious. And when the indigenous peoples who had very advanced, sophisticated social technologies to dispel the Wendigo from one person, and the white people arrive and they've got an entire culture that is Wetiko.
Yeah.
What do you do?
Yeah.
It's contagious. It destroys everything in its wake.
And then to connect just briefly to Bateson here, I think it's really interesting that he was a very hard-nosed atheist, but he spent a lot of time hanging around with people we would characterize as hippies because he found that the insanities that the dominant culture science contained in it, he found them to be just far more egregious than what he called the minor insanities of people with a more religious mindset. And so he had this idea of an epistemology of the sacred. That is, how do we know? Because it's part of what your book is. If we have a Thrutopia, it's saying, well, how do we know how to get there? How do we know what's the better way to know? Because that's really what we're talking about. If we try to even know our way there with the current style of epistemology we have.
No problem is solved from the mindset that created it.
Right.
It's not going to happen.
And
you have to ask the web of life.
That's right. And so this is what Bateson is sort of inviting us into. So he's very careful and analytical and very atheistic. He says, what has been said so far can be read as an argument or evidence for the reality of very large mental systems, systems of ecological size and larger, within which the mentality of a single human is but a subsystem. Now, this is a very crazy thing for him to suggest, but he goes a little bit further with it. I mean, it's just already there. We have a hard time thinking that a forest is a mental system. He says these large mental systems are characterized by, among other things, constraints on the transmission of information between their parts. Indeed, we can argue from the circumstance that some information should not reach some locations in large organized systems to assert the real nature of these systems, to assert the existence of that whole whose integrity would be threatened by inappropriate communication. By the word real in this context, I mean simply it's necessary for explanation to think in terms of organizations of this size, attributing to these systems the characteristics of mental processes. Mm-hmm. And he says essentially these things might seem like gods. He said, what characteristics would such minds expectedly show? Are they perhaps the sort of thing human beings have called gods? This is just a different way to say it, but it is a way to say that even the dogged scientist would have a place to look you in the eyes and say, yes, there are gods who dwell in this place. I may have a different view about their ontological status, but there's something here that transcends human intelligence, and it should be consulted.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then the only question is, how do we consult?
Yes. How?
How do we hear the answers, and how do we bring them into being?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Okay. So how do we do that? Because one thing that I noticed in the story is you have a group of fairly exceptional people. There happens to be a strong tech-savvy dimension to what happens and what unfolds in order to get things done. But I wonder about this. Although those people do get help from a larger ecology of mind, the help that they get does still largely remain, shall we say, kind of human, not. I mean, it might be too strong to say that it's human-centric, but let's say that there is a strong asymmetry in the agency and the direction from which. So let me put it this way. No one sits around and says, let's ask the trees what we should do.
No.
I wonder. I wonder about that. Given that that seems like a thing that you, I mean, the horse guy, like it's a horse tooth and it's guidance that has you sit and listen and receive this, right?
Right. Yes. I thought you were asking a very specific question. I wasn't answering it. Yes. No,
that's okay.
Exactly that.
Yes.
Yes. However, okay. So let's. For the people who haven't listened to all my other podcasts, very briefly, I was teaching one of the more advanced shamanic groups on this summer solstice 2021, and I had a series of visions while I was drumming that were considerably more plain text than is usual. And the plain text was, take this 30,000-year-old fossilized horse's tooth that holds a particular part of the gate that I was working with on the altar, find some ethically sourced horse hide, which took me months because it was lockdown, go up the hill on which, outside my window that I live and work with, and sit in a particular place, having bound the tooth to a very dense, wide, horizontal bough that's part of a very old laid hedge that was probably laid back in Tudor times. Bind the tooth on, sit with it in the smaller of your back, looking then southwest down the valley, in a particular frame of mind for at least an hour, as the sun goes down every night until further notice. And I don't get plain text very often, but I have learned absolutely by bitter experience that you listen to it straight away or you wish you had. And so I did all of that. And the other thing to say is this was, I did the Masters in Regenerative Economics 2016-17, came home, we moved house, we moved to the small holding. My life completely changed. I started the Accidental Gods membership program, started the Accidental Gods podcast. I didn't think I was ever going to write another book. I had a podcast. You know, we'd record it. This could be live, or in my case, we tend to record it and it goes out 10 days later. It's a much more efficient way of getting ideas out into the world than a book that takes genuinely a year to write, a year to edit, and a year to get out. However, I sat up the hill, and by 9 days, I had the first scene of the book, and the three void walks therein, and the understanding that it needed to be a Thrutopian novel. And that you say all these people are exceptional, and my editor said something like that, and I think they're really boring, ordinary people of the sort that surround me all the time. So they don't seem exceptional to me. Partly, I did spend 4 years of my life in a computer games company, and I was playing World of Warcraft as my displacement activity while I was writing the book. So It does make its way in. However, I needed part of my remit to myself was that we show a route from a recognizable present towards that future that we would be proud to leave behind. And it felt to me too much of an ask for the average person to expect them to get on board with listening to the Web of Life. I need to cough again. I'm just going to switch off my...
Take your time. I'm going to put on an image here. I'm going to share an image while you're talking.
Yeah, there we go. I'm back. But you can share an image anyway.
Yeah. So I, a part of what you were doing was watching corvids. And,
I was indeed watching the crows go to bed.
Yeah. Did you see this one? Yeah,
this is, I always work with, I've been working with crows for a long time. Yes, I can. That's gorgeous.
That's
and cat.
That's the two of them.
That's also cat. Are they your, I mean, are they the ones that work with you?
They
Do you work with
these two ravens come and visit all the time. And they're very good friends. So I like that you were up there and there's an image there. I mean, these are different corvids. You were watching crows, but I also really want to honor the fact that there is a very powerful Odin and Yggdrasil vibe there because, of course, Yggdrasil is Odin's horse. And so putting the horse tooth there, which...
Yggdrasil is the ash tree. Sleipnir is the horse.
But if you look at the etymology, Yggdrasil means... It derives from... You're thinking of the big, massive
the
horse.
The actual mythology. But, okay, yes.
No, but the word indicates that it... Yes, the word itself is sort of like... It's connected to this idea that Odin was a shaman riding the horse because the shaman rides the horse into the between.
Yes.
Yggdrasil is the tree of life, but it is, in that case, Odin's horse that he rides for 9 days. And so over the course of that 9 days, most people don't know about that horse connection. It's sort of, it's an etymological one. There's also something beautiful there, of course, because Buddha, sometimes people like to say that he was a shramana and that shramana as a word made its way into Siberian culture as shaman.
Oh, interesting. So, right.
Anyway, that is to say, and I'm mentioning that in part because for those people here who have heard me talk about it, you'll pardon me, but there is a literature on brushes with death. And the brushes with death literature indicates that when people have a brush with death, they can make a significant life change. So this happens all the time. And what's interesting is if you look at the characteristics of a brush with death, this is not a so-called near-death experience where you are clinically dead. This is like I'm driving down the highway, my car spins completely out of control, and I think I'm dead. I think this is it. And then I get out of the car, and I think, what the hell? And then I have to change my life. That's it. And so this experience is one that people can access. But here's what's beautiful about it. If you compare the literature of what that's like and how it unfolds, it compares very favorably with mindfulness, meditation. Right. And meditation is supposed to help you, and especially in the context of a holistic spiritual life, a holistic ecology of practice, it is meant to do the same thing. And in some cases contains various rituals, rites, ceremonies, but the death happens on the cushion. You thankfully don't have to go through a car accident, but somehow or other you encounter the same thing. Similarly, though, you cannot just go away for a weekend and it is too powerful, it's too strong. We're not in a place where we can very easily metabolize that. Okay, but let's go back. So what you were suggesting, and here I want to raise a legitimate question, I think, because for me, this is where, you see, my work is trying to teach people how to enter into that larger ecology of mind. Mm.
Right.
So my general view is that actually, because here's another thing that Bateson said that I think is so fantastic. When he's describing how this ecology of mind works, he says, when I go out and I do something, unfortunately, I think that I'm the one doing it. Mm. And anybody who makes that mistake shouldn't be in power. That the fundamental issue is so intimate that for him, the only way we can think differently is that we would have to confront the delusion that we are ever possibly disconnected from the web and that it does not, it must work through us. And suffering, ignorance, destruction, degradation is the thought that we could do something without it. So I'm wondering about that space. And oh, in yes. my defense, I just want to say, like, okay, they're exceptional in the sense that they're all very capable, highly intelligent. They're highly coordinated as a group. They've been thinking about this stuff very hard for long periods of time. They know a lot of stuff. So they all seem yeah. like they would be, you know, high level performers at lots of things, so whatever.
Okay.
You're right.
Okay. To me, they're right. Okay. And I forget that this isn't the space other people are in. Anyway, they are yes, what they are. And they the are aim there. Is to give people a grounding in. And the key thing about the book is that every single thing that happens in the book as a potential is already happening somewhere in the world. I didn't make any of it up.
Yes.
I just knitted it all together.
Yes, that's true.
And yep. I think that's a really important, even the tweet that is at the kind of apex of the thriller arc of the book
yeah.
was a tweet that a 12-year-old girl sent. It just got taken down very, very swiftly after she posted it.
Right.
In the days when Twitter was a place where
yes.
ordinary people could hang out.
Right. So that's so, yeah. an interesting thing, people. What tweet might actually instigate a massive power change? Because it didn't in that case, but you are imagining that, okay, there was an energy there, because let's just think of it in those sort of weird metaphorical terms, some kind of energy there that might have been sufficient to create liberation. And that's maybe what we're looking for here, but yeah. okay.
Yes. What would allow a movement to arise? What would unite enough people from across all the different fractured spectrums that have been very deliberately split apart in our culture?
Yeah.
Around what could we all unite?
Yeah.
With enough impetus to create a whole new system that makes the old system obsolete. We're back into Bucky Fuller space.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah.
I mean, I would kind of wish Standing Rock had been like that, but I mean, boy, that was like, you'd have thought there was enough energy there. I mean, okay. So can you, so then what happens is there is this attempt to make a case that we need to shift. And here too, I just want to, we can ask some questions. Would you be so kind as to read what happens in the course of this as they're trying to create the opportunity for change? And here, you can set the scene for us and then read us a little selection. This is not the mytho part, but we'll talk about that too.
Yeah, I mean, no, this is more of the really, political
part. Yes, this is the political part. But I'm interested in that. I'm interested in all of it. So
this is probably about two-thirds of the way through the book. The movement that we referred to has managed to trigger an emergency general election in the UK. And our movement is going to field candidates who are notionally independent, but who all adhere to the same value set and who agree to work from that value set. And we have someone who's arisen as an emergent process of the movement who was a journalist and has been invited onto Question Time as a BBC, notionally a debating area where let's not get too political about this. It's a BBC notionally debating area that I stopped watching in 2016 because I just couldn't handle what it was doing to my blood pressure. However, I have got my character onto Question Time. So her name's Leah, and she
has a PhD, right? So this is
a PhD. Okay. Well, yeah,
that's not your run of the mill check. This is a very bright woman, right?
Yeah,
okay, yeah, yeah, okay.
Yeah,
right.
She is super bright. Actually, yeah. Leah is designed to be super bright.
Yeah,
and she's part Iranian, part British, I think. I can't remember exactly. But anyway, she's definitely not white, which is relevant in the context of the racism of the time. Let's spell this out. Our entire culture is addicted to fossil fuels, and it's destroying not just us, but the entire planet. We've burned more oil since 1995 than the whole of the rest of human history, and the whole net zero thing is the most monumental greenwash. But it's not all about the carbon. There are forever chemicals in the rain and microplastics in the clouds, dead zones in the oceans, and mines you can see from space that are polluting whole continents as we try to dig up enough minerals to keep the wheels of consumption turning. Our politicians tell us that we live in a democracy, when what we have is a kleptocracy devoted to finding ever better ways to monetize the apocalypse. We all know things are bad. There is not a single person on the planet who thinks we're on the way to a better world. What we argue about are the ways to fix it. You'd think it was obvious. But let me spell this out, too. Cutting taxes on the ultra-rich is not going to help anyone heat their homes or pay for good, nutritious food in a world where the seasons are beginning to break down. Rounding up everyone whose skin isn't white and weaponizing infantile culture wars is not going to suck the carbon out of the air or make the water safe to drink. Did you know there are now dozens of toxic chemicals in women's breast milk? And it's still the best possible food for newborn infants, but we have no idea what this is doing to them. Nobody does. Do you want me to keep going? Go on for a bit.
Yeah, keep going. I like it.
Locking up protesters while you drove for more oil is not going to stop the epidemic of depression and suicide or heal a health service that has become a sickness service because we live in a system designed to make the rich richer and keep the poor running like hamsters to do work that's never going to pay. I know this. You know this. So why do we let the system keep us running on a treadmill that everyone hates? I will tell you. We do it because nobody's ever asked us what we really want.
I like that. Now, here's the thing. She says that, and there are so many people who are thinking to themselves, yeah, but there are people who are thinking, well, no. And I wonder what you think. You have the Steven Pinker, Bill Gates, and who do they love? A nice young Scottish woman she's young. She's not a boomer, but Hannah Ritchie. She's told us, Manda, that you don't know Hannah Ritchie?
I have no clue who you're talking about. No, that's interesting.
Here's a young Scottish woman who, let's just do this very quickly, and we can have a little philosophical commentary, the shaman and the philosopher. And let's see, I have to say that I will share the sound.
A Scottish data scientist. Oh, she's at Oxford Merton School. Whoops.
Yeah. So she's a very bright person. Here she is.
I think many people today feel doomed about the state of the planet. They see climate change and they think these problems are insurmountable and we just won't be able to solve them. Now, I've previously been in the same position. I just couldn't see how we'd possibly be able to tackle these problems. But actually, by stepping back to look at the data and looking at how the world has changed over centuries, you can actually find examples of really big environmental problems that we've already solved. So it's not like humans aren't capable of solving problems. We are. And you can only see that when you switch off the news and step back to look at the data. You can see that while we face really, really big and urgent problems, we are developing the solutions, and these challenges are solvable. My name is Hannah Ritchie. I'm a researcher at the University of Oxford, and I'm deputy editor of Our World in Data.
Okay, so I'm going to stop there. So Hannah's going to go on to tell a story about how, and keep in mind, Bill Gates loved this book. So you know that the way this is being framed, because Manda Scott is also saying, hey, we have a lot of ways to solve this already. And, you know, I'm the philosopher saying, okay, but just please don't anybody do anything just yet. Because I am actually more, I do think we have to just get more people out in nature and connected and through community and communitas. But, okay, so set that aside. But what she's going to say is essentially, hey, don't worry about it. We can mine our way out of it. Because if you compare how much we would need to mine to how much we're blowing on petroleum every day, it's a fraction. And so, yes, electric cars, okay, yeah, have people walk more and not drive as much. But basically, you don't have to stop
business
capitalism.
As usual with a few tweaks in there.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Given that my church is called the Church of the Fallible Human. And in my church,
grand.
The first thing that we do when we introduce ourselves is I'm Nikos Pazidakis, and I am a fallible human. And even though I very much think that we are in a highly critical, urgent situation in which we all have to be as calm as possible in the face of that urgency, maybe I'm wrong. And Bill Gates and Hannah Ritchie and Steven Pinker, one of my favorite people to pick on, Enlightenment Now, maybe they're right. And what do you think of that view? And on what basis are you thinking? I'm sorry. No, come on. I mean, this is somebody with a PhD in data science. It's very powerful.
She's at Oxford Martin.
She outflanked you with data. So no, I just, okay, what do you think about it?
She very, very carefully cherry-picked the data that would suit her argument, which is, you know, and I can cherry-pick data too that will suit my argument. So we could throw data at each other all the time, or we could accept that no problem is solved from the mindset that created it and head-minding this problem. This is not just a problem of carbon or climate, it's a problem of total ecosystem collapse. This is a complex problem, and you do not fix it by sorting the data points. And I think that's a seriously important point to get across. And if Bill Gates really believes you can, he needs to go back to school. I'm really sorry.
Well, he did drop out.
I'm quite happy to be a Scottish, another Scottish woman going, that's absolute, utter, unmitigated bollocks.
Okay.
Sorry.
No, we don't mind bollocks here in America. That's not even
and
a swear word.
Fallibility is great. Is it? Oh, okay.
Yes.
What I think I had a very interesting, there's a Substack, I can send you the link, of someone who had a conversation with Deep, whatever it's called, the new Chinese AI that doesn't eat up huge amounts of power and water, DeepSeek. And they said, so is collapse really going to happen? And DeepSeek went, it's okay. IPC says no, not really. And they went, you believe the IPCC? Are you serious? And it went, okay, since you said that, no, well, probably we don't actually believe the IPCC, so things are going to be quite bad. And this person eventually, they're pretty collapse adjacent, and they got it to say, okay, yes, collapse is happening, ecological collapse, societal collapse, yeah, okay, it's happening. And then this person said, okay, so can someone like Musk, could they, with all the money in the world, could they fix it? So we could put in Bill Gates, all the money in the world, could we fix it? And it said no. And they went, why not? And it gave a list, and I'm going to read you number four in the list, because I think this is really crucial. Number four says, what could be done but won't? In theory, the following actions might slow collapse, but they're politically, stroke economically impossible. They are, number one, degrowth. Rapidly scale down energy resource use to 1970s levels, rationing essentials, abandon GDP, profits, and consumerism. That's number one. Number two, global mobilization. Redirect 50% of global GDP to relocalize food systems, restore ecosystems, and decommission fossil infrastructure. Number three, end industrial agriculture. Shift to permaculture, reducing emissions by 30%, which are 30% of total, and halting soil erosion. It could have said an awful lot extra about sequestering water and all of the other stuff about increasing biodiversity, but it's got there. Four, terminate the military-industrial complex. Redirect $2.1 trillion per year. This was made a couple of weeks ago, so by now it's twice that. In war spending to hospice care for civilization. So it's been reading Vanessa Andreotti. And then it says why this won't happen. These all require dismantling hierarchies of power, which no elites, including Musk, will ever endorse.
Whoa.
We know what to do, and they will not let us do it because they might lose a few years of power.
Mm.
I have the novel. I just need the time to write the novel that goes, no, actually, we're doing this. Because you do not get to tell us that six mass extinction is happening because you like being in power.
Yeah.
Tweaking the existing system is not a part of what we need to do. And the concept that it might be is not just wholly wrong, it's actually dangerous.
Right. I mean, I agree with you philosophically, right? And so, I mean, I just sometimes, there are times when I actually hope that Hannah Ritchie and Bill Gates are right.
Yes, absolutely. Well,
okay, great.
Sleep at night.
Yes. But,
I can train dogs and horses and forget about everything else.
Yes, exactly.
I'd be really happy.
The thing that Bateson, one of the things that I like about his work is that as he goes through and carefully, rigorously defines the nature of mind, which is also the mind of nature. That's how we open up the podcast every day, the nature
it's
of mind and the mind of
I
nature. But also, of course, that's influenced deeply by the philosophical traditions, which ask us to discover the nature of mind directly, experientially for ourselves. So if there's a deep thing that's going on, this whole thing, it's Bateson and it's really resonant. But what he says is when we talk in terms of power, we are being seduced by old, outdated ideas, because ecologies, he says, do not operate on the basis of power. They operate on the basis of meaning. And the problem, the mistake that we're making, is giving the metaphor of power the meaning it has And instead of trying to then take back power or rebalance power or whatever, just stop using the metaphor that way and realize that the meaning of your life is being constrained rather than, I think it's an interesting thing to think about in terms of, you know, how do we think our way forward in a more holistic thinking, like a whole. I know that you sometimes say head, mind, and heart, mind. As a philosopher, I say, let's not have the division. If we just stop, call the stuff that we've been doing schmeasoning and say, let's actually start reasoning. Because schmeasoning won't solve the problem. Yes. But reasoning, if it's holistic, right? If it's imaginal, if it's spiritual, if it's, it has all the elements and it has right intention, as you note, is so important. Right intention.
Yes. Intention.
Focus.
Is everything. Yes.
Stability of mind. All those are elements that you're teaching people the basics. The shared across wisdom traditions, that you have to have intention, you have to raise up that good energy, and you have to have stability of mind in order to do it. Those are key things that are really, they're subtle. I wish those would have been on the political platform, that everybody now has a right to know how to use their own mind. Yes. Like, we need an amendment of the soul, that you should have the time and the teachings to find out what the heck your mind actually is and how to use it. Yes.
Yes. But that, yes, absolutely. But, and to get there, we need a total shift in our value set.
Uh-huh.
Because we won't get there while the vast majority have values that are shaped by a sense of scarcity, separation, and powerlessness.
Yes.
Where we're in the trauma culture, so there's two sets, if we move to neurophysiology, cognitive neuroscience, there's two sets, broadly, this is really basic stuff, of... reward centers. So the serotonin mesh that we talked about with the initiation culture, that's pride and respect shared and evolving and connection to the web of life and the whole of that heart expansion. Trauma culture, we cut ourselves off from that. And we are, Nate Hagen says that the whole of our culture is devolving barrels of oil into microliters of dopamine, because all we can do to fill this void inside is, and the point about dopamine is that it's short term.
Yeah.
It's not additive, and it's subject to the laws of diminishing returns.
Yes.
So the cocaine that I snorted yesterday, or the porn that I used, or the likes that I got on the internet, or the my political tribe won, and you know, we all beat the libs. Jonathan Haidt did a whole bunch of really interesting functional MRI work where your political side winning is as big a dopamine hit as a nose full of cocaine. It's totally addictive.
Wow.
And you will set it up again and again. And again, and the people who can give it to you are your dealers.
Yeah.
And that says an awful lot about what's happening in our culture just now.
Yes.
And yet, they're short term, they're not additive, subject to laws of diminishing returns. You need a bigger hit, a bigger win every single time to get the same dopamine hit, and it never lasts.
Yeah.
And it doesn't fill the void inside. It is never going to. There is no number of boxes from Amazon or rockets sent to Mars that are ever going to fill the void inside.
Yeah.
And so we need a whole value shift. I have a Substack that I wrote recently. I would like to just suggest to you, because I'd like to see what you think.
Sure.
So the basis of the Substack is, the existing system is not broken. It's doing exactly what it was always designed to do, which is to shovel power to the top.
Okay.
However, it is not fit for purpose if that purpose is a continuation of complex life on Earth, if it is the flourishing of humanity as an integral part of the web of life, if it is a world predicated on values of compassion, decency, integrity, generosity of spirit, and absolute confidence in our place as conscious nodes in the web of life.
Yeah, yeah.
If this is the case, then we need a whole new system, and we need a movement to bring it into being. And for that, I think we need basic asks that we can all coalesce around.
Yeah.
And what I have at the moment, and I would really like to see what you think, is clean air, clean water, clean earth, as in soil, earth, and also... Yeah. Clean, clear, courageous, compassionate connections between all parts of ourselves. So we need to do the inner work. Between ourselves and each other. So we need to do the building of community. And between ourselves and the web of life.
Yeah.
And that would be my basic ask of the movement. Do you sign up to that? And if not, why not?
Yeah.
Which bit of clean air, clean water, clean soil, clean connections do you not want?
Right.
And why not?
Yeah, yeah.
And if we do, then if everybody in the world... made those their basic, everything that I'm doing is working towards those and nothing else, the whole death cult of predatory capitalism would be gone by tomorrow.
Yeah. These are very basic. I mean, it's really, really remarkable that that it's so threatening to consider just asking for clean water. I mean, that's what Trump has done immediately, right? Go after the EPA. And this has been a long time, ever since Nixon made the dreadful mistake, which is weird that that president in particular. But this is what freaked everybody out, was that that movement got things like the Endangered Species Act and the Environmental Protection Agency. And so there has been this kind of war on it. And that's the thing, is that we can't be told that this is, that you just don't get to have clean. I mean, it's such a weird notion. You just don't get to have clean water.
You don't get to breathe clean air.
You don't get to breathe clean air.
Water. You don't get to have clean breast milk.
What a weird.
There are toxins in the umbilical cord,
the placenta, people, men's testes, our brains. I mean, it's just getting worse.
Yes.
I'll mention to you as a side note, just because I think you might find it interesting when you were referring to the inner ecology. I think here too, especially for someone interested in shamanism, but I often recommend this, is Machi Glabrun was a tremendous yogini. She was a wonderful yogini about 1,000 years ago. She developed a process which is a much, much, much more shamanic and much, much, much more holistic version of IFS, internal family systems. So
I love IFS, so she's got it even better.
I think you would really. Now, there are two versions.
Is this feeding your demons?
Yes, that's the secular version, which is still more holistic, right? Because it's about touching the nature of mind, not just working with the
parts. I found it terrifying, but yes.
Yeah.
I spent 8 days doing it, and then I was going to hit insanity, and I stepped back.
Okay. So, well, as with anything, you have to have, you know, there has to be support, but it doesn't have to be. I mean, I work with feeding your demons and even help clients go through the processes like that. Okay. And it can be done in a way. The point of doing the more secular version is that very responsive, just the same way IFS would be. And it's much more, it doesn't have the shamanic elements. But in the original versions, of course, you were going out and doing a ceremony, possibly at a graveyard, possibly in a forest or another dark place, because she saw the inner demons and outer demons as sort of not really so different. And so, in other words, if you're feeding a demon, the demon might be fossil fuels. But the demon is also in you. There's a way in which you have to see that that demon is there, and it's obstructing liberation. And so how could we do it? Because as you say, these energies, they're never going to stop being hungry. So she's finding a way to actually feed them, so there's an okayness.
Yeah.
And the ritual and the shamanic dimension, you were talking about horns made of bone, you know, like a human femur bone is blown, and there's a drum, and it's really, you know. But in the more secular version, you're just two people sitting there, and you go. And it's very important to have support. It's very important to have support. Okay. I mean, I know that you're a more advanced practitioner, but it's very important to have somebody there with you for that process.
Yeah, it's quite exciting. Yeah. I'll talk to you about that later.
Yeah. So I wanted to share another passage with you. And there were two passages that I thought of from that I thought you might enjoy. Have you ever read Jitterbug Perfume?
No.
No? Okay. So this is by one of our philosophical novelists. So here is a discussion about our situation. Is not Pan a male god? True, he is, but he is associated with female values. To diminish the worth of women, men had to diminish the worth of the moon. They had to drive a wedge between human beings and the trees and the beasts and the waters, because trees and beasts and waters are as loyal to the moon as to the sun. They had to drive a wedge between thought and feeling, between the lamplight by which they count the day's earnings and the dark to which our Pan is ever connected. At first, they used Apollo as the wedge, and the abstract logic of Apollo made a mighty wedge indeed. But Apollo, the artist, maintained a love for women. Not the open, unrestrained lust that Pan has, but a controlled longing that undermined the patriarchal ambition. When Christ came along, Christ, who slept with no female, neither two-legged nor four, Christ, who played no musical instrument, recited no poetry, and never kicked up his heels by moonlight. This Christ was the perfect wedge. I don't like that he's scapegoating too strongly, but Christianity is merely a system for turning priestesses into handmaidens, queens into concubines, and goddesses into mere muses. That's Tom Robbins.
You're going to end up in El Salvador if we're not careful.
Yeah. I know. I think he's being a little. It's too easy to pick on the spiritual materialism of Christianity, but I do think it's interesting that the soul requires these sorts of maneuvers that we have to be really consistently wedged away. And it was a long wedging away because there were little tendrils, as you know, holding on. And then today it's just like some people are out there really actively trying to hold this. And so many others are radically disconnected because we're all alone in rooms watching Netflix. And
there's a whole branch of Silicon Valley that thinks the natural world is an aesthetic option, which means they can choose not to have it.
Right. Well, or it's a really fun place to visit. You get to go to somebody else's nature while it's still there because you destroyed everything that's there's around you. Okay, so let's talk about the mythopoetic. I mean, Tom Robbins is doing it a little bit there, and he does it with Pan, and Jitterbug Perfume is this really interesting, funny, quirky story that's worth reading. And the last thing, I'm going to read you this bit, because you also, there's something about the courage that you are asking from your characters. And so I want to encourage people to read about the courage that they have to have. And this is the same story. There's a young woman, and she is, her name is Kudra, and she finds out that she has to be married away. She's living in India quite a long time ago. I can't remember that. It's been years since I read this, but many, many, many years. And but Kudra, she loved her father and their business, which was incense. And she just really was into making incense and perfumes. And it was just, she was the most skilled child. And she's told that she has to go marry this other person, this young man, and she doesn't want to go. And he says, "Do not worry, my little patchouli drop. Your betrothed's family has a very fine business," prays Shiva, "and is said to be short-handed at the shop." That proved to be the case, but her husband's family did not make incense. It made rope. Rope. The gods have a great sense of humor, don't they? If you lack the iron and the fizz to take control of your own life, if you insist on leaving your fate to the gods, then the gods will repay your weakness by having a grin or two at your expense. Should you fail to pilot your own ship, don't be surprised at what inappropriate port you find yourself docked. The dull and prosaic will be granted adventures that will dice their central nervous systems like an onion. Romantic dreamers will end up in the rope yard. You may protest that it is too much to ask of an uneducated 15-year-old girl that she defy her family, her society, her weighty cultural and religious heritage in order to pursue a dream that she doesn't really understand. Of course it is asking too much. The price of self-destiny is never cheap, and in certain situations it is unthinkable. But to achieve the marvelous, it is precisely the unthinkable that must be thought. I thought you might like that.
I love it, except for the bit about the gods, which strikes me as straight out of trauma culture thinking. But yes.
Well, here's what Bateson and Matschig would say, is that some of those energies, while we remain ignorant, they will...
Yes, they exist. That's very true.
Because they are the gods that will not be mocked. That's what Bateson is saying. So when you do something to the web of life, like ignore your own destiny, then they are going to...
Yes, that's very true. Yes. Yeah. The four books that came after the Boudicca series, set in ancient Rome around the time of the Great Fire of Rome, and I think I discovered the historical basis for Christ, who was not one person, but three separate people whose stories got crushed together. Ah. And yet, there is no question but that there is an energetic entity that fulfills the, to me, somewhat psychopathic role of the Abrahamic God and all of its various offshoots, because enough people have given serious amounts of energy, their own and largely other people, they've killed very slowly and very nastily, to this God, and then it exists.
Yeah.
But it's a trauma culture God.
Yes, that's right. It's a demon. It's a demon. And Okay, so the part of what you're trying to introduce people to, though, is how we would think differently. You have solutions that, as you say, you kind of draw, and they exist and they're fascinating, and some people might not know about them. And that's all really interesting stuff. But then there is a person who, at the beginning of the novel, we watch this person die. They go into the bardo, the between, and another space called the void. And we're watching the kind of maybe shamanic dimension of the changes. So it's like you're allowing that something shamanic might have to happen, but maybe the people who are, like, maybe on the surface what people see is not that. They see sure. results.
Thank you for noticing.
Yes. So which is kind of helps them because you're imagining, okay, well, maybe, yeah, people can't quite handle it. I mean, who knows though, right? Because that's what Jung said. Jung said that the archetypes are like dried up riverbeds. And that what happened in Nazi Germany was that Wotan got woken up and that people weren't ready for it. They didn't understand the energy and there was so much ignorance. So, but the idea would be, well, why then couldn't there be a positive case where an archetype is awoken and people yes. do ride it? And in a yes. way, you're using, I mean, sure, they're using the crow, the horse, you're using the tree.
The salmon.
Of course, the salmon. I've got the salmon of wisdom around my neck along with horses. So, yes, and I appreciated their appearance. Just talk however you would like about that. About, okay, so yeah, I wanted to bring in this mythical dimension, but then I understand the gap between where maybe some people are at, and here's just talk freely.
Alrighty. So the first thing to say is that that particular part of the novel came from my sitting on the hill. I was given the first scene in which a woman in her 60s is lying on her bed. Her 15-year-old grandson is at her side. Mm-hmm. And he says, when you come home, can we go up the hill and watch the crows go to bed? Which is exactly what I'd been doing. And she says, no, I'm not coming home. We've had this conversation. I'm dying. There is no coming home from here. And he completely falls apart. And he says, you're the only one that gets me. I don't want to live in a world with you not in it. And she realizes he's serious and she says, I have no idea what comes next. And she should, because she's been an anthropologist explicitly looking at people's death ideas around the world for all of her adult life. But anyway, I actually don't know what's happening. But if you really need me and you call, if it's at all possible, I promise that I will come. And then he and she and we all feel the gods pause in their labors and go, okay, that promise, we heard that promise. You will be held to that promise. And then she dies. And then the whole of the rest of the novel, as you said, is told from that between space, between the lands of life and the lands of death, which in shamanic terms, because one of the functions of a shamanic practitioner is as a psychopomp. So that's a fairly well mapped out realm.
That's guide of souls for, yeah, that's exactly, a lot of syllables for me.
Yes. So. Yes. The newly dead take them to where they need to be. Yeah. So they're not hanging around and infecting the living or affecting the living. And the other thing that I saw in the journey in the visions was that she makes three void journeys. And again, the void is a space that is known in shamanic terms, but it is also a space in which total dissolution can happen if you don't know exactly what you're doing. So Lan is terrified of this space and she's already dead. And I want to make that really clear because people seem to think it'd be a fun place to visit. And trust me, total dissolution is not something that you want to play with for the fun of it. Yeah. And so, but the point is you get into the void if you know how to hone your intent cleanly and clearly enough. Mm-hmm. You can split the timeline and you can see various possible futures. So she's taken to the void. The crow that is her guide splits the timeline for her that first time. And she sees multiple ways in which Finn does kill himself. And then she's kicked back into the land of the living with the instruction that the point of this is if you can take agency in the lands of the living, you may create a timeline that does not exist yet. And so give it a go. You don't want him to die. See what you can do. And I read so many books. I read a lot of near-death experience books, but also the ones that have been gathered of people who feel they have been approached by the newly dead. And there was a particular one where there was a surgeon in the States, I think an orthopedic surgeon, and his closest friend, they had both played, must have been in the 80s, one of those early computer games where you're basically just trying to shoot goals, score goals against your opposition. And every time he scored a goal, it went, whee! And he got a phone call late one night to say that his friend had been on holiday, I think, in Portugal, and he had drowned while trying to save their son in the sea. And our guy was completely devastated. And in his broken state, what he could think of to do was to sit down and play this game in honor of his friend. And he said all night it was going, whoopee, whoopee, whoopee. And it was logistically impossible within the coding of the game that he could have been scoring that many goals.
Yeah.
And so he felt that this was his friend reaching to him through their shared medium saying, I'm okay, it's all right. Yeah. And so whether that is the case or not, he felt it and he was healed. Mm. But it also gave me an idea of what Lan could do to connect with this boy with whom she had played World of Warcraft. So that was built into the book. The next two void walks, one was going to be looking at the movement that I believed I could build around this, the core of Lan's remaining family, And I really wanted that to be multi-generational. I think whatever we do now, every single person alive on Earth now is part of it. We can't assign it to any given generation. And then the last one was looking at the ways, if we take the metaphor of humanity being in a bus that's barreling towards the edge of a cliff, she sees all of the ways that we could go over the cliff. But again, if she can take agency, and by this time she's been cast out of the family, basically, if she can find ways of taking agency in the land of the living, she might still be able to affect the overall outcome of humanity. And that's the point of the book, is what can we do? And we take whatever help we can get. And I wanted at least to introduce to a thriller audience, because I was writing a thriller, the concepts that the web of life exists, that other help exists beyond the material world that we are taught in our terrifyingly narrow culture is all that exists. And to an extent, this book's been out since last May, so not yet a year. I'm getting very regular emails from people for whom it has opened doors. So up to that point, it's working.
Yeah, and this is an auspicious time of year because the events unfold in the spring. Something must have happened on this day, I think, but it's around this time where equinox. It's a good time to be speaking. So it's March 18th. This won't be released right away, but what's interesting about that image is that this too is part of, see, I often give this inversion of the perennialist view, is that there are many paths up the one beautiful mountain and everybody's got the same view. And I usually say, well, actually there's one path, but many mountains. And because the paths all have very essential elements like development of intention, real intention, and what it's like to have an enlightened intent that is stable and focused. And there is this need to use the mind. But it's also interesting that, of course, we both would say you cannot just go running into high levels of meditation, but let's look at part of what the image is. There's a person who is dead and has to find agency among the living, and that's kind of the description of humanity. I mean, we're all going around. Socrates said we were asleep, but you may as well say, well, you're dead. You're dead to what you really are. And somehow you're going to have to figure out how to get the clarity of intent and stability of mind to find out how to have what agency means in a world that's completely interwoven. Because what does agency mean when the world is totally interwoven?
Totally, yes. And you're experiencing it as fractured.
Yes.
How do you reconnect with the interweaving? How do you get that ripple effect so that other people begin to resonate with you? I keep getting images of resonance. I had a dream the other night where I was watching resonance shapes in water. It's how do we create the standing wave?
That's right.
In a way that connects people at a heart level.
Yes. Yes. Yes, because in fact, communication is not the sending of messages from one being to another, but the creation of resonance in apparently different locations that are not different, right? So, okay, so I want to bring us to a close by just asking if there's anything else you'd like to add or anything. I don't have like one of these grand ending questions, but if you want, you can let us know where you're going next. You have another book in the making. Is that what's going to happen?
I did have, and it became up. I wrote the first 15,000 words between March and May of last year, end of book in March, coming out in May, and it was obsolete. It was rendered obsolete on the 5th of November. So it's quite interesting, writing a political book at a point where the writing process is going to take, there's no way, with the best will in the world, anything that I chose to write now would not be out before 2027. The world will be different. It's kind of hard to predict how. So I'm looking at a much more, I have a whole bunch of others. I keep going to the hill going, what do you want of me?
Yeah.
And nothing came. And then in the space between the solstice and New Year, we're very suddenly two grant applications out of nowhere. And so we just discovered we got through the first round of one of those. And it's if we get the funding, it's to promote the concept of Thrutopian writing at a much, much bigger scale. Because it needs not to be just me. If anyone's listening who writes anything from blogs to poetry to songs to YouTube videos to novels, please don't write business as usual. It's propaganda for the death cult of predatory capitalism. Please get out there, do whatever works for you to find out what we could be doing. There is so much out there. I think part of what I realized, I did start something called the Thrutopia Masterclass, and it still exists, because I realized as soon as I was given the impulse to write this novel and sat down and went, okay, guys, I need a lot of help with this, because this is going to be much harder than writing historical novels. However, I had been running the podcast at that point for nearly 3 years. Every single week I spoke to someone who's at the leading edge of doing something in this kind of what we might call metamodern field. I hate that phrase, but it kind of covers it. And so I had a clue. And then we, for 6 months, we ran the Thrutopia Masterclass every alternate Sunday for 6 months. And we'd have somebody come and talk about, I know, alternative political systems or governance systems or economic systems or food and farming systems or transport systems or power generation, and the people to talk about spirituality, and a few people from the film industry and the publishing industry and theatre, all of whom, to a man and a woman, said, no, it's never going to wash, you're going to have to do it yourself. But I think that's different now. But the first hour someone would talk, and the second hour I thought we'd do lots of workshops, and actually what we found was we were doing a lot of holding of people in emotional crisis. Because they were a self-selecting group who'd come on this. And it's still, I think, I still don't understand how people don't understand where we're at. But part of the way we don't understand where we're at is that everything on page, stage and screen around us is telling us that fundamentally the system, exactly as you said with Bill Gates, we just need to tweak a few parameters, change the data points a little bit, everything will be fine.
Yeah.
And that's not only untrue, I think it's dangerously, insanely, deliberately damaging.
Yeah. Yes, because of course, too, then this is why there's a crisis of how do we really know anything? I mean, it's an old question in philosophy, and Socrates started with it. My friend Derek Jensen was on here recently, and he was talking about postmodernism as being an expression of that question of, well, how are we
what
supposed to know?
Yeah.
And it's damaging when people lie to you. And you know, it's hard to know exactly, but one of Trump's advisors supposedly, you know, was in an interview and claimed that this would happen. He said, you know, he would give a speech, and after the speech, I would say, why did you say all that stuff? None of it's true. And he said, it doesn't matter. And not only does it not matter, if I say it enough times, people will think it's true anyway. And it's sort of astonishing, and that is an insult to the soul. Whatever, it doesn't matter. I'm not talking about politics here in the ordinary sense. I'm talking about what happens when that happens. It doesn't matter if you like Trump.
When we elevate the dark triad, it doesn't really matter who it is.
Yes.
Because the old system, you know, much as I would have liked to see a female president in the US, it was wholly corrupt, and Israel would still be destroying Gaza. Ukraine would still be fighting Russia. The Nord Stream pipeline would still have been blown up.
It was the same with Obama.
Was still carried on.
Yeah, Obama was the same situation.
Yeah, they're either waving a pride flag or they're not. And I absolutely get that what's happening in your country is the destruction of liberal democracy.
Yeah.
And that's horrible, and lots of people are going to suffer, and I'm not suggesting otherwise. But we needed the old system to go.
Yeah.
I would not personally have taken a chainsaw to it in the way that's happening at the moment, but it needed to be got rid of. And so, you know, there's another very old aphorism of the cracks are where the light gets in. I think the one thing we can be sure of is we are in a hyper-complex system, and you cannot control outcomes.
Yeah, yeah.
And they cannot deny their way out of biophysical reality either.
Yes.
So whatever they think they're going to do, I think the one thing we can say for certain is it's not going to work out the way they think.
Yeah.
So that gives people who do get it a chance to build from the ground up the clean water, clean soil, clean air, clean connections between all parts of ourselves, each other, and the web of life.
Yeah.
What does it look like if we base all of our life, if we give ourselves in service to the web of life?
Yes.
Ask it, what do you want of me? And do our best to respond to the answers in real time.
There you go. That's it. That's the Dangerous Wisdom message too. I mean, there's a way in which I would call this a Thrutopian podcast or a Thrutopian initiative.
Yes.
It's the idea.
Yes.
It's how do we really think differently?
It's been wonderful
to have you here with us. Thank you so very much. And thanks to all of you for listening. If you have any questions, comments, suggestions, stories to share about your Thrutopian aspirations, or maybe you're feeling the calling, you can get in touch. And maybe if you have some great questions, we can bring Manda back to talk. She's doing a lot of good stuff. So send them in through dangerouswisdom.org. Until then, this is Dr. Nikos, your friendly neighborhood soul doctor, friends. I'm looking forward to talking more about the way through. And so until next time, remember that your soul and the soul of the world are not two things. Take good care of them.